Green Grey, Reel 5.
Oh, dear, oh, dear.
So you still have your cards?
I still have my two cards upstairs from both my boys. I had John, my first boy, and a funny instance, I've always been a lightweight, not so much now with increasing years, but when I had John, my weight averaged somewhere about 7'14", 8 stone, you know. Another time we had a very lovely old doctor here. His name is still remembered. He was the medical officer of health for New Forest, but he lived in Totten. And when John was born, he weighed 8 pounds 4. And I remember my doctor gently chastising me, saying, "A woman your size shouldn't have had that baby that weight." I said, "Well, I can't help it, you know." Anyway, time passes on. We were quite friends too. He was a very friendly type of family doctor. When I had Colin, 2.5 years later, he was 8'11". And his remark then was utter disgust. He threw his stethoscope across the bed. He said, "What did I tell you before? All I can compare this to is a racehorse giving birth to a cart horse." That's very nice of you.
Were you given any vitamins or orange juice?
Cod liver oil and orange juice, yes, which I religiously took.
So you would, from what you've said, it would seem that pregnant women were looked after very well in the
Well,
world.
I would say so, yes. We had as you do invariably, a few women that said, "Oh, utter nonsense, you know," but it wasn't. There was a reason. I mean, if you're going to build a healthy little body, you've got to have the nutriment to build it, haven't you?
But how about things like a pram? I mean, would you find it difficult to get a pram in?
Terribly, terribly difficult. You had dockets for everything, you know. And it's rather funny, you mentioned that one subject. I was still, of course, working down there. And during a morning break, the only thing you could do then was, when the sirens were quiet, dash out quickly if you had some shopping to do and get back quickly. I went down to one of the local shops to see if I could pick up some fresh vegetables. And as I passed the shop, there was a general haulage shop next door as well. And they were just delivering one pram. I went, forgot all about my vegetables, and I went rushing in to see if it had been allocated to anybody, because I had got a document. No, not yet. So although I rushed out on my bicycle to get some vegetable shopping, I left my bicycle and I went back pushing a pram, much to everybody's amusement. But it was a pram of sorts. It was virtually a wooden box, nothing, you know, absolutely austerity. It was nicely padded inside, but outside it was just a green painted box on four wheels with a very lightweight hood, you know, no brakes on at all. The only thing you could use for a brake, you bought a dog's lead, you know, with the clasp at the end, and you fitted it onto the handle of the pram, so that you put the clasp then on one of the wheels so that it could only use a certain way and no further. Oh yes, life was very difficult. Lots of mothers didn't even have prams or cots. You used to put them in a drawer. If you've got a chest of drawers, they used to spend a good few months as their bed in the chest of drawers. I was lucky. My husband's a handyman, and he managed to get some timber, and he made a little cot, a carry cot, a handle each end, so when the warning sounded at night, if he was asleep, he'd just pick it up. And night after night, I've sat under this table with him and the great golden dog as well. Because by then, when I'd finished, the intensity of bombing, of course, was ending. But instead, we had what is known as the doodlebugs, the V1s and the V2s. And they were really horrific things because it was completely indiscriminate. We didn't get many here in this area, but I do remember seeing them. It's the most awful noise, the engine, and you'd see it tearing across the sky, and then the engine would stop, the noise cut out, and then you waited, because then it started plunging to earth. It used to probably arc first, and you didn't know where it was. And of course, it was indiscriminate. You know, it hit anything. The same as the big causeway at the same time. We found the big bridge here, which I mentioned, which spans the River Test, dividing Totten from Southampton. During the bad nights, the bridge at about dusk time would be crowded with people elderly people mainly and kiddies walking out from Southampton to try and get in the forest, get away from the intensity and the Germans coming over machine gunning the people on the bridge. That was about the same period in the V-bombs, etc. It's horrific. And again, I can count one or two instances of local people I know who, as I have just mentioned, people gave a helping hand to anybody in those days. And I do know of three instances where an elderly couple have been wandering over the bridge to try and get out of the city, wheeling a pram with the blankets on. They were going to curl up under a tree, and where they were spotted by local people, and they said, "Where are you going?" And the answer, of course, has been, "Oh, just anywhere." And they've said, "Come into my home," and they've gone. And in one particular instance, actually, he was an ambulance driver. He didn't have children at the time. It was just he and his wife. They had a bungalow in Totten. And he was walking over the bridge this particular night to come to headquarters, and he found an elderly couple just like this. And they said, "No, we just want to get out of the city." And of course, he said, "Right, come home with me." And he took them straight home to his own bungalow, and they are still there. Grown-up elder, the ambulance driver moved on long ago, and his wife, but the couple are still in that bungalow. And there must be many, many more instances like that that you don't know.
You were saying about D-Day, you know, that description of the aircraft going over and tipping their wings.
Mm-hmm.
Was there much sort of build-up in this area for D-Day that you were aware of?
No, funnily, not here. In fairly, neighbouring villages, such as Marchwood, which is only a few miles away. There's a military port, of course, Marchwood. Yes, obviously, from people living there, you could see the build-up. But here, well, I didn't go out of the village hardly, you see, I couldn't. So you didn't see anything else. But from things you hear afterwards, yes, the Marchwood people must have known, because the build-up was starting with landing craft and things like that. But and Southampton itself, of course, if you live there, from what people say, of course, I didn't see it myself, obviously, but because my husband worked in the city, and he's, of course, involved in shipping too. He said the build-up of the landing craft, he said, was absolutely phenomenal. He said you could walk practically the whole of Solent by standing on one and walking over, you know, hopping over. I can remember afterwards, not before, when the war ended.
Yes. The other thing I was going to ask you, you know, I was wondering how you sort of amuse, and you're obviously very busy in the war, but, you know, did you get any entertainment, for instance? I know there wasn't television, but would the radio have been important in wartime?
Yes, it was, really. It was about the only thing you could. All cinemas were closed and theatres.
Can you remember any particular programme or personality who sort of summed up the war for you on the radio?
Actually, I'd be honest, I don't think I can, because I, for one, didn't often listen to the radio. I wasn't home enough to do so. But I can remember one or two characters, but the thing is, I'm not sure of the time of them, you see. Sorry, I haven't touched it. Oh, no.
Was the music? Was there any music that you associate with the Second World War?
If I've got the timing right, I might be wrong, you see. It's years. I used to like, when I could manage it, Saturday lunchtime, the Light Commodore Orchestra. But that's about all, and I'm not sure whether that was the war years or not. No. Actually, the only entertainment, apart from, say, radio... Oh, you had in the beginning, come back. People we had heard on the radio occasionally, but then suddenly, all at once, when war started, obviously a lot of the people were immediately drafted into the forces on various places, and you suddenly got on the radio... The same people, practically every day, all day, every month. Reginald Fort at the Tower Ballroom, Blackpool. I think all day long he was pounding out the organ because there was nobody else to put there. Things like that. You got, in a way, tired of the same people and the same sort of performance. But, and that went on for some considerable time. If you've got a strange voice, a new one, it's quite a red letter day. But I do remember Red Fort and the Tower Ballroom, Blackpool, very much so.
Can you remember, you know, at the headquarters, although I know you would have been a mother by then, but obviously you were still involved, when your sort of vigilance was able to slacken? You know, was it after D-Day, would you say?
Oh, yes, I think so, looking back. But, well, of course, the bombing had slackened off then. That was the Blitz years, 1940, 1941, of course, the worst period for bombing here. So then there was the phasing out period, if you like, almost, prior to we were expecting invasion, because it was not a question of if invasion comes, it was when invasion comes. All the literature we had pumped through the doors and on the radio, Winston Churchill's voice, etc., he used to give talks to the nation. And say he didn't pull any punches. He told you exactly what to expect. And then, of course, it was during those they formed the organisation known as the Home Guard, which now, of course, is a subject of fun on TV with Dad's Army. But
how true is that, do you think, to what your knowledge?
Oh, a lot of it is true, but of course, I don't think people are quite so dim as they make out in this programme. But it is quite true in the beginning. Men had no weapons or anything. You got broomsticks, anything you could lay your hands on, ready to wallop a German if he should come. But it is far-fetched, Dad's Army, really. But, of course, it was combined mainly of men who were probably, that's why it was known as Dad's Army, too old to join the forces. But they were still capable of packing a hefty punch if necessary, I think. And my husband was in it for a while, and then he suddenly found, well, you can't do both, because civil defence is passive, Home Guard was just reversed. So he was told in the end to stick with civil defence. You know. And even then, funny memories, you know, come around with him. We went through a period of, during the war years, sometime, of a spate of so-called fifth columnists. And, of course, people began to be suspicious, perhaps, of one another, you know, for various reasons. And you were told to be very vigilant and report anything you were suspicious about. Of course, people were very vigilant and often used to report all sorts of daft, silly little things that had no connection. But nevertheless, you did as you were told and reported it. One night, my husband was on duty with me down there. It was during the time of the fifth columnists. And you were told to report anything suspicious about anybody. It sounded awful, really, but there was a reason for it. And I heard a report in during the day from a local neighbour that she was suspicious of another neighbour, two or three doors away. She said, we've no petrol. I mean, there's petrol rationing, so nobody's got any petrol, you know, for their car. She said, but every night when the warning sounds, this particular man gets out in his car with his family and clutters out of the village and goes up towards Tatchbury Mount. Now, Tatchbury Mount is a mental hospital up the top of a hill, about 2.5 miles away from here. It is quite a hill, you know, quite. And she said, shortly afterwards, you will see from the top of that hill, and that's the way it goes, you will see a light being flashed when there's any aerial activity overhead. Well, that sounded very serious, had to be investigated. So the chief warden there, that same night, had this in mind, and he said, right, I want somebody up there to watch and take a note of the time the car goes out, and to stay there, take a note of the time the car returns. And then he'd notified someone at the hill to watch out for lights, this sort of thing, as you can imagine. So he thought, right, who can I send? And then he suddenly thought, ah, you live up that way, meaning my husband. He said, you go up there. He said, there was a big ditch right opposite, because their place wasn't built up like it is now. It was mucky, wet and horrible, so he had to lay in the ditch. Foggy night too. Sure enough, the siren sounded, out went the car, so I've made a note of the time of it. But he had to stay there, you see, and they forgot all about him. The car didn't come back, and he was laying there in the valley ditch practically all night long, soaking wet. But in the end, a man known as the security field officer, an ex-army man, his job was this, for security. He came into the head warden and he said, as that car came back in, we've got a report on it. And he said, no, we said. And then he said, oh, forgot all about him. The poor fellow's still up there. So he said, who did you send? So the chief warden said, oh, one of my wardens called Gray. And the language flew. He said, you're silly, so-and-so. He said, that's the very fellow we're watching. But it was one of those awful coincidences. The family concerned hadn't been there long, and their surname was the same as ours. So at the panic stations for a while. So by then, of course, my poor husband was grilled by the field security. Make sure it wasn't, you know, the same Gray. But it turned out innocently. But so you couldn't ignore these things if you did think something was wrong. It was a question of they'd got the wind up, the same as we all did, and somehow he managed to have some petrol. So every time the warning sounded, he'd pack his family in and shy off up there, you know, up there. And the only light actually there that we just thought was right, there was a herd of cows up there, it was right on top of the hill, and the cowman would come out with his torch looking at his
cow. But why did they think your husband was suspicious?
Well, because it was the surname. We didn't know the name, you see. It was the same name. And until he'd sorted it out a bit, he thought he was doing a double-purpose job, you know. He'd gone up there in the ditch, and he thought, oh, dear. There was nothing to do with the fifth columnist, but he just didn't dare take any chances.
Do you remember the day war ended and, you know, the V-Day celebrations?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I was, the previous day, on the radio, there was every sign or every hope that it would be signed. It was a hope, a good hope. Next morning, I'd stayed in bed a little bit longer. I'd had a tough night with John. And the first I knew, my husband had got up early, you see, and he'd put the news on. And the first I heard was he opened the door at the foot of the stairs and bawled, get up, it's over, because he'd heard the official announcement, you know. And then we came down and had a little embrace together, this sort of thing, we were still together. And because everybody then was out in the street cheering and shouting and being the first thing that I must admit, and of course some people didn't agree with it, church services were arranged for the same evening, the local church is here. And some people with no religious instinct at all, you know, thought we'd just build. But it wasn't. But the two churches were absolutely jam-packed the same evening, 6:30. And the next day, of course, were people who'd let their hair down. And my husband said to me, I wonder what the old city's like, meaning Southampton. He wanted to see the shipyard because the shipyard took an awful lot of hammering, and he was company secretary. Oh, he wasn't, not then, no, he hadn't reached that position. But we had John then, my eldest son. He was only a little thing then, of course. He was born in 43, so he's near enough two-ish. And when we had John, we were still riding a tandem, and we had a little sidecar on the top, which you did have in those days. They were very comfortable, too, for a little kiddie. Hammocks slung, you know, perfectly. So we put John in the sidecar, and we toddled off to Southampton to see what activities on there. And one of the meeting places, of course, in Southampton then was the old Royal Pier, which was demolished, unfortunately, long ago. And we went into town. We left the tandem in a side street. And in those days, we didn't even have a bicycle lock. You didn't think about it. You could leave your bicycle anywhere. Nobody stole bicycles. So we didn't even own a bike lock. We just flung the tandem down in a side street, picked up John, of course, and wandered onto Southampton Pier. And I have never seen anywhere such a crazy crowd in all my life. The pier was jammed, packed full of people. You had a job to walk anywhere. Some people were a little bit merry, managed to get something to drink, cheering and bawling. And I remember one instance, there was a car, old battered old wreck, agreed, because there weren't many about in those days. And there were two very merry gentlemen, who were forces gentlemen, they must have been on leave, I should think. They just came along, singing and bawling at the top of their voice, and got hold of the car, picked it up, and straight over into the water. Absolutely, of course, by the end of it, we didn't stay all that long, obviously we came home, but I shall always remember the cheering and the shouting. And the singing of patriotic songs, somebody started it. And the one in particular, There'll Always Be an England. And it was most emotional to think, you know, what we'd been through and England was still there.
How did that compare with VJ Day, would you say?
Oh, I think that was more exciting and more exuberant than VJ Day. I think it meant more to us, I suppose, really, because of the enemy activity from Germany more than anything. But your thoughts were with them, nevertheless, the prisoners of the Japanese prisoners of war. It's funny now, talking about things like that now. As I've told you, we belong to a cycling club, a happy crowd, you know, mixed cycling club. And a mistake too, in those days, cyclists on the road are well behaved, especially a cycling club. You had strict rules and they were adhered to as regards road behaviour. And every year now, November the 11th comes along, and I can still, in mind's eye, see a crowd of happy, bright-faced young men who were caught to the forces and who didn't return, members of the cycling club. And I can still hear their laughter echoing down the years, the fun we had. When you remember the bright faces, full of hope, and 18-year-olds, you know, and say very few of them came home again. They were immediately put into the Royal Hampshire Regiment, of course. And you can't help it. Every November the 11th, you know, I think of them, the fun we had in the past, and they didn't come back again. We used to have long weekend campings as well, you know, and not far, just on the edge of the forest, because, say, in those days, nobody had any money to go anywhere. But if you had a bicycle, you could travel a bit, and we managed to collect a couple of old tents, so moth-eaten, and but just for long weekends, it was great fun. And we had, in those days, very, very rarely did young people go off the rails. You never thought about it. You really didn't. We had two tents there, one for the boys in the cycling club, one for the girls. There was never any question of any wrong behaviour or anything. It was scrupulously morals adhered to. But I do remember the war cloud, to say, were gathering, and some of the young men I'm talking about knew they'd had their papers, you know, the red stamp. And whilst we were in camp this particular weekend, somebody came out from Southampton to say they had got their, it had arrived, they'd got their call-up. And I remember the bustle at once. Tents were packed up, and we couldn't get them back to Southampton because the boys used to leave them and cycle out now and then. And they had to ask the farmer, they had to get back quickly, could they leave the tents in the farmer's garage? And he said, yes, sure. And to my knowledge, they're still there. Could we just have to leave it, everything, you know, and come home? And then the boys were gone. That was that, you know. And that's the last we saw of them.
Do you think the wars had lasting effects on your life?
I think so, in certain ways, obviously. As I just said, previously, it again reinforced my opinion that good health and a sense of humour are the finest things in life, because in all married lives, as a rule, you have some ups and downs and some bad spasms, and we have had some bad spasms in our married life. But somehow, if you can find the lighter side of it, even though you might say afterwards why, you get through it somehow. I mean,
do you think that being through the war, you know, and doing the things you've described, do you think it had made any difference to you, how you felt of yourself as a woman? Your self-image as a woman, do you think?
Well, I think the image of, my image of, excuse me, of a woman, for that matter, if anybody, is to live life to the full, the life that you have been given, and to give a helping hand as far as you possibly can. I think we were all put on this earth to give a helping hand to each other. And looking back over it, I think, as I said just now, I think it's the example my parents set. The standard of life was very high in those days, even though people were very poor. And I think the idea of honesty not lying, etc., things like that, and doing your job as well as you possibly could. I'm sure it's bound to rub off on you, because I've had this feeling, whatever job I've had in life, knowing that you're being paid for your job, do it well, to the absolute best of your ability, and, as I say, be honest and give a caring hand wherever you can.
And also what you were saying about the women in the war that you saw and how they coped. Do you think, you know, that war did something for women, or women did something for war, perhaps, would be a...
Well, I think it's both ways, because when war came, until, say, war came along, say, a married woman wasn't allowed to go out to work. But when war came, it was a totally different story. They wanted all the women they could possibly get their hands on to work the jobs that men had been called up. And then, from that day onwards, men, it was amazing what women found they could do. They took on all the men's jobs where it was possible to do. I mean, it's not far away, it isn't there now, but at Totten there used to be a yard known locally just as the timber yard. And there the firm used to bring in these untreated bulks of trees, enormous things, that were eventually going to be turned into telegraph poles, things like that. But they came in, you see, with the branches and everything on enormous trees, and I can see the women now that had always been in a house doing housework. Now they set to mind, to some women, the attraction obviously was extra money. Made a world of difference to them. But I can see them now in dungarees, you know, and hair tied back out of the way, everything, with great big saws chopping off the branches and everything, and they went through the whole process. And you get about six women lifting manually these great logs and turning them over so that they were tarred all over, you know, for protective, weather protective. And practically any job you can think of that men did, women did. And this makes me mad now when you hear disparaging males talking about women. Yeah, it's so, so unnecessary and so uncalled for, because I still think it is very much a man's world. We've come a long way, but there's an awful long way to go. I mean, once upon a time, they'd have frowned at the thought of a woman doctor, wouldn't they? Well, now there's a high percentage of qualified women. They've got brains the same as men, and they're just as capable of using it, and as long as they have the chance of education. I always feel a bit sorry that educational chances came a little bit late for my age group, because now, if I wasn't my age now, I would like to go back further education. But it wasn't possible. You left school at 14, which I did, and the majority of my friends did at that time. That was the end of it. Now you go out to work. But I do look back and regret the opportunities that weren't there that I would have liked very much. I would have liked to have qualified properly in something. Yeah.
You seem, from what you know you've been describing, that you've got a lot of satisfaction from what you did in the war.
Oh, yes. The companionship, too, the various types of people. And you certainly saw, very much so, a cross-section of humanity. The different kinds of people and the different attitudes to life of people. There.
And your work at the headquarters.
Yes, I was on control more than anything. Totten was a funny area, really. It's the biggest area of New Forest, most highly populated, and therefore also, being so near Southampton, more vulnerable than the rest of the forest, obviously, because with so much open fields about, even if HEs did land, the chances are they went in open farmland and didn't do destruction. But here, say, we had such a high population for the largest part in Totten, and it's just amazing to me that we escaped with what we did. To be honest, we had one instance that was very tragic, I thought. There was a farmhouse up the A36. It's built on now all round, but at the time it was just one little cottage and miles of open farmland, and a mine dropped one day right on the cottage, killing all the people inside, and yet there was all the empty. Talking about mines brings another funny story. The River Test, of course, flows behind us here, not very far away, behind my back garden. One night, the earth shook, windows flew out, doors flew out. A parachute mine had been dropped in the Test, and it had exploded, of course, a terrific flash, you know, and I say, all the earth shook, and wardens were out, you know, and calmed down to see what damage. But at the time, of course, it was all pitch dark, you couldn't see. But as the grey light of dawn came along, the wardens knew near enough the position it had gone in. They were touring the area. There weren't many houses there, luckily. But there were the grey light of dawn, walking round to see if all houses and people were all right, but suddenly realised that on the River Test, the surface of it was covered with floating dead salmon, because the mine had exploded in the water, and therefore the explosive force of the water had stunned the salmon, the famous salmon test pool at the back here, and stunned the salmon, killed them, and they were all floating at the top. So that day, practically everybody in Testwood had poached salmon for tea, half-starved population.